podcast where we look at the U.S. Constitution, its major concepts, and how it is, and isn't, working today. Last week, we rounded out our coverage of the three branches of government. That's executive, or president, legislative, or Congress, and judicial, or the Supreme Court, for those of you keeping score at home. Before we move into the remaining articles of the Constitution, I've got a little Christmas present for you. Dr. Christine Bailey from Austin Peay State University in Clarksville, Tennessee, will be joining us today to talk about judicial interpretation. Remember last time we talked about how Article 3 was really short, but somehow it seemed like the judges have all this power? Well, one of the things that makes this happen is the concept of judicial review, the court's ability to strike down acts of Congress or the legislature that are incompatible with the Constitution. PBS Crash Course does a great, quick episode on this that includes the famous case, Marbury versus Madison, where the Supreme Court spells out its power, with Chief Justice John Marshall in 1803 saying, "It is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is." Now, some people wrongly attribute this to the rise of judicial review to this specific court case, but the idea was circulating in the Federalist Papers before the Constitution was drafted, because after that Articles of Confederation debacle, we realized that there needs to be some neutral ground on which people could work out their legal conflicts. But since judges do have this power, it's important to understand how they got it, and how they make decisions. But it's also important to understand how they think the law should be interpreted. So Dr. Bailey's going to give us the skinny on that and help you get into some fun fights at the holiday table. Let's go. All right, so would you like to introduce yourself to our audience here at the Civic Flame?
Hello, Civic Flame audience. I am Dr. Christine Bailey. I'm an assistant professor at Austin Peay State University. I specialize in judicial decision making and gendered issues within the law.
That's exciting and sounds like a hot topic right now.
A little bit.
Maybe. But all right, so today I have asked you to come talk to people about something I know about but don't explain as well as you do, which is judicial interpretation. I'm more, as you know, of a 14th Amendment kind of a gal. You're definitely much more on the judicial side because, as I tell my audience, the law is a big tent, even for those of us who are not lawyers. So can you tell us a little bit about what judicial interpretation is and how we know how judges do it?
Yeah, sure. So judicial interpretation at its core is essentially judicial decision making. It's how judges make decisions in cases. And it's a really fascinating and ever expanding area of research, which is the reason why I've chosen it as my primary area of study, because there's a few different things going on when you're thinking about the way that judges make decisions. So first and foremost, most importantly, the law is supposed to be completely neutral. You're supposed to be able to win your case regardless of what side you're on. Everything's supposed to be fair, right? Like, there's a reason why when we see pictures of Lady Justice, she's blind, right? She's got her eyes covered because justice is supposed to be fair no matter who is standing before a judge. But at the same time, we don't have robots making decisions. We have human beings, and judges are human beings. And so they make decisions just like every other human on this planet. They carry with them all of their experiences from their life, all of the knowledge that they've gained in the course of their academic education and legal education. They carry the experiences that they've had on the bench, and all of those things factor into the way that they decide cases, which may or may not be the way that things are supposed to go, legally speaking.
See, that does explain it better than I could explain it. I'm just like, I don't know. It's how judges think about stuff. So are there different types? Like, how do we decide how somebody, like, are there types of judicial interpretation or is it just one thing?
Yeah. So lucky for us, researchers have, of course, created several theories. Theory. The first and main one is known as legal formalism or the legal model. And this is basically just the way that you would expect the way that judges make decisions to work. Judge takes a case, they take all of the facts of the case and the information that's provided to them from both parties, and then they take relevant legal precedent and the law itself and make a determination based solely on those things in front of them. So,
okay. So before you do that, I do want to remind the audience, a legal precedent is a decision that the judges and the courts have made before that people tend to rely on later on when they're doing another case.
Yes, exactly. So that's legal formalism. Basically, you can think of it as like the quote unquote traditional way that judges are supposed to make decisions, or that we think about the way that judges make decisions. And then there's some other models that exist, some other theories. One of the largest and most predominant within political science research is known as the attitudinal model, which was created by Jeff Siegel and Harold Spaeth in the 1990s.
I have been saying Spaeth wrong for a long time.
Did you not know it was
I did not Spaeth? Know it was said that way. I'm bad at pronouncing words. And I had braces, so now even my enunciation is weirder than it used to be a few years ago. I'm a mess, readers and listeners. I'm a mess.
You got Jeff Siegel's name right? Because I got his name wrong the first time I saw
it. It was Seagal, wasn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Which thankfully, the one time I met him, I didn't call him Mr. Seagal or Dr. Seagal, but like, yeah.
No, so attitudinal model, now that I took us down a side quest.
Yeah. So the attitudinal model is basically the idea that the legal formalism model is good, but not quite good enough. That judicial decisions are a combination of all of the things contained within the legal formalism model, but also that individual judge's attitudes and personal beliefs can factor into a decision. So, for example, if you have a judge who is hearing a case before them that involves someone who robbed a bank, and their daughter happened to also be a teller at a bank, that judge might look at that defendant a little bit differently than a judge who didn't have a family member in sort of a similar occupation or a similar situation. So that's the attitudinal model. There's also a few others. I can go on and on. There's several.
Give us one more big one. What's one more big one?
One more big one is legal realism. And this is sort of like the attitudinal model, but also includes other elements. So things like judges are human beings and they want to expand upon their leisure time. They won't want to spend all of their time working. So they can't. No, imagine that, right?
They get so many more weeks of vacation than I do, though.
Right? So they do things like plagiarize language from party briefs and take shortcuts. Or they may choose, if we're talking about appellate litigation and a judge sitting on a panel with other judges, they might decide not to write a dissent simply because they don't want to put the time and effort into writing that dissent. Basically, it's this idea that there's other things that can factor into it, as well as all of the things in column A, the legal formalist model, all of the things in column B, this attitudinal model.
I kind of like that one.
That one's my favorite.
It speaks to my inner cynicism.
Yeah. Yeah. All of the above and none of the above. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I think we also see a lot of people. I know when I was at BU, I was at Boston University, for those of you whose center of the universe isn't New England, that BU. I was asked by the Federalist Society to come and talk to Justice Alito, which I declined because I felt like that was more of a full-time tenured with protection professor thing to do. I didn't want to get myself into a scenario that was probably not where I should have been. And I know that Justice Alito, among other judges, use what they call originalism. And there's been a really interesting book called The Originalism Trap, as well as a book by Justice Breyer called, I don't remember what it's called now. I'll put it up on my website, but it has to do with like legal pragmatism and how to read the Constitution. And so it's not just that these are formal kind of theories. There's some fights about how that works in practice. And do you want to speak to anything that you see? Because you do more with court decisions than I do.
Originalism is basically this like type of judicial decision making that judges use, wherein they try to look to whatever it is that the framers had intended when they wrote whatever piece of legislation or part of the law that the judge is reviewing, and that is sort of the best way to go about interpreting or making decisions in any given case. I completely
See,
lost my train of thought.
no, that makes sense. And for me, it's funny because there are things I think that makes sense for, like structural things. How old do we want Congress to be? Or what do we need you to do to run for the president? Or what power should individual branches have? But I call myself on this podcast a constitutional radical because I believe the Ninth Amendment says I have all the rights, and the government has to prove to me that not only do they have the power, but a reason to make anything illegal. So I kind of feel like, to me, looking at originalism, I'm like, if your originalism is about structure, it makes sense. If it's about individual rights, it doesn't, because even the founders knew we weren't supposed to be stuck in 1787, right? They put more perfect union as a way to say, yeah, there's room for change. So to me, it's one of those always a kind of a balance of sometimes this works and sometimes I see it work badly.
Yeah. But also, one of the other sticking points with originalism is that the founders themselves, famously, I'm sure you've discussed ad nauseum in this podcast, the founders themselves didn't agree on everything in every way. And so, if you're trying to figure out what the founders' intent was, you can kind of, in some way, shape, or form, legitimize your position based on debates that were happening back in the day. Like, there's multiple different issues within the Constitution that, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton famously fought over. So if you're trying to find this sort of one true source or one true theory, it doesn't quite work with the framers just because they themselves weren't entirely on the same page with each other and fought against each other. So.
I say a lot that any ideology is a cop out. You're using the ideology to do the thinking and to do the explaining instead of taking responsibility for what you're doing. Like, if you think this is compatible with the law and something that we should do, go ahead and say that and show me. But the minute you start throwing out an ideology, I'm always like, really? Are you just using the fancy book words to try to justify what you're doing? Because I'm on to you. But I'm a sucker for a good argument, which is a problem. It's a problem. It's a real problem. So, yeah, all right, cool. Is there anything else you want to tell us about judges, judicial decision making, anything you're working on in the future that we might want to keep an eye out for?
So most of my work looks at whether or not judges make decisions differently based on whether they're a man or a woman. And also, the one thing that we haven't really talked about at all in all of this is that one of the biggest components of decision making is the information that is brought to the judges that the judges are able to make their decisions on.
You'll come back when we
And
talk about rules of evidence.
right, exactly. So, there's another sort of actor that when we're talking about judicial decision making often gets left out of the conversation, and that is the attorneys. So my work focuses on how the attorneys can influence this process, and that's sort of what I'm cooking up at the moment in the academic kitchen, as it were.
At some point, I also want to talk about judicial clerks. There's a fun book called, I think it's The Sorcerer's Apprentice, that talks about the role of judicial clerks as getting certain information to the Supreme Court judges as well. And so it does really, we have to ask like who's getting what information and where are they getting it? Because it's not as though these judges just come in either completely cold or completely briefed. though they've already had a certain type of information given to them in advance. So yeah, lots more questions about this. Although I think for that, we'd have to just start our own separate podcast.
We could do an entire podcast just on judicial decision-making alone.
Well, we could. And I was talking to a friend who wanted to do a different news podcast, saying how we should do what they do over at Behind the Bastards and Cool Zone Media and create our own kind of podcast ecosphere where we have simultaneous podcasts so we can all be guests and help each other out. So dear readers and listeners, that is that might be the future of where we're going. But all right, I'm going to say thank you to you and end our recording here. So thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody.
Well, I don't know about you, but I enjoyed that conversation a lot. My friends laugh at me because I talk about epistemology, or the study of how we know things, all the time. But really, it matters why people think they know something and what it means to them to know or to understand. A little meta, maybe, but since Tufts never called me back about that political philosophy job, I'll assume I'm not too far gone just yet. Since we are getting into the holiday season, I've got to put on my mom hat and start wrapping Christmas presents. I totally did not buy too many, and baking enough cookies to feed a medium-sized army. That means we'll be taking a break for a few weeks, but we'll meet you in the new year with new content, the rest of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and hopefully more guests. In the meantime, help us out by sharing widely on social media. We're not on Facebook anymore, but if you are, share, 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 please. And follow us at Dr. Fun Sponge on Instagram, Substack, YouTube, and Blue Sky. I'm going to work on marketing and distribution on the break, but it's always better when it comes from real people in the audience. Until next time, keep the civic flame burning bright, stay warm, and have a wonderful holiday season. The Civic Flame is a Dr. Fun Sponge Media production with creator Amber Vail and sound producer Matthew Munyon. Thanks for listening.